tell us something about your childhood, where your story begins. When I read the book, you start as a kid who wants to grow up and be a doctor, and then things go really wrong. Tell us about that.
Unfortunately, like many other young men and women growing up in some of the households that I have an opportunity to mentor, I grew up in a household where I was dealing with high levels of child abuse at the hands of my mother. And that ultimately led me to running away from home when I was 14 years old.
Now, with your father, though, you had, and there's a divorce in there, and actually a little back and forth between your parents getting together and splitting up again. And that's really hard on a child. But your relationship with your father seemed to hold strong all through your life.
Yeah, I mean, me and my father, we had our difficulties. I think the reason that our relationship is what it is because he was able to admit his frailties as a man and as a husband. And, you know, one of the big questions I had for him at one point was, how could you allow this to happen on your watch? And, you know, he explained some things to me from a husband's perspective. And my father worked a lot, so he wasn't always home. He was mostly at work, with the exception of days he was off. And so we were able to talk through a lot of things, you know. And just for the record, you know, me and my mother, we're now in a good space. We've been able to talk through some
good
of things. And, you know, my mother, she came from a very, very abusive background where she had been abused and on a very extreme level. And so her position was she thought that what she was doing to her kids was the right thing because that's the way that she was raised. So, you know, we've been able to heal some of those hurts and move beyond what transpired back then.
Yeah, it's often the story with abuse that we treat others as we've been treated. There's a cycle that perpetuates itself there.
Yeah, definitely. And then the other part of it is just like identifying what is abuse, because oftentimes when you grow up in households where corporal punishment is kind of the legacy, we don't call it abuse, you know? And the only person who can recognize or call it abuse is the person who's being abused, honestly, you know. So we were able to work through those things and kind of navigate our way through that in a healthy way at this point.
Good to hear. But then you're a runaway was it age 13? And that seems like a really big turning point in the direction of your life after that.
Yeah. I was around 13 or 14. And when I ran away, I had all of the emotions attached to what was happening in the household, the emotions of wanting to be loved and accepted. And like many young kids who find themselves homeless, I was extremely vulnerable to older, more seasoned street hustlers, you know, because they offer all the things that you feel like you're missing.
Right.
An opportunity to make money, shelter, clothing, more important, acceptance. And so that's basically how I was seduced into the drugs, right?
And then from there, take us to, again, some really transitional points in your life when you were shot and then that moment that takes you into the Michigan prison system.
Yeah, so, you know, growing up in a drug culture, you know, I was around 13 or 14 when I first entered that culture, and I experienced every imaginable horror that comes with it. You know, childhood friend being murdered, being robbed at gunpoint, being beat nearly to death. And eventually at the age of 17, I was shot multiple times standing on the corner of my block. And what I didn't realize back then is that I was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the things that we don't talk about enough in, you know, when it comes to what's happening in inner cities, and that played out in a very negative, traumatic way 16 months later when I got into a similar conflict as the one that I got shot in, and instead of being shot, I fired what turned out to be 4 fatal shots, tragically caused a man's death, devastating the family, actually devastating 2 families, and you know, leaving another void in our community. And I was subsequently sentenced to 17 to 40 years in prison.
That moment when you're taken into custody and you go through the hearing, the legal process, and your first moment of walking into prison, try to paint that scene for us. And considering the numbers of, what is it, 2 million in prison in this country, I have a feeling most of us don't talk about it if we know someone, if we have a friend or a family member, because it's not the thing that you're the most proud of.
Yeah, I think one of the things about the American prison system is very clandestine. Nobody really knows a lot about what goes on in there, largely because there haven't been that many people who've been able to articulate it in a way that brings people inside that world. And it's one of the reasons that I decided to write Righting My Wrongs. I really wanted to bring people as close to the experience as possible without them having to be arrested.
Yeah.
For me, walking into prison, you know, I was 19 going into a very volatile world. And the first day I was actually in the main prison, because you go through quarantine, first you're in quarantine for like 30 to 60 days, where they're kind of assessing which prison to send you to. Mm-hmm. So I was sent to Michigan Reformatory, who was, you know, had the nickname of Gladiator School because of the high levels of violence inside. And that played out the first day I got in prison. You know, I watched the guy get stabbed extremely bad in a stairwell heading to the chow hall. And the way the other guys walked past him so casually basically marked for me in my mind that, you know, I was basically in the jungle.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to adapt to the code of that environment. And I mean, I grew up in the city of Detroit, so it wasn't that hard of a stretch because, you know, I grew up in the streets where it's very volatile and fights and, you know, shootouts and all these things occur. But there was just something really different about being housed in a prison with 1,500 angry young men who a lot didn't have anything to lose because most of them were serving life sentences or extremely long sentences. And so, you know, the violence between the men who were inside and amongst the officers was at an extremely high level back then.
Mm. And you write in your book about the culture of negativity, which we've just gotten a sense of too, listening to you, that these people are, if they're not already broken down, this whole system seems to really break them down even further. And the only way to survive is to wear this mask to perpetuate this image of toughness. I'm tougher than you are.
Yeah, I mean, the system just isn't designed to foster the best in people. You know, when I first went in, they did have some, you know, we could go to college and kind of get out of the you know, get away from the prison, day-to-day prison life for those few hours you were in class. But for the most part, it's just a very predatory environment, and negativity is actually encouraged. And, you know, when you think about...
How is that, Shaka, that it's encouraged?
I mean, the officers understand that, you know, when people owe money, that there's likelihood that somebody's going to get shanked. Mm. You know, everything negative that we've heard about ourselves growing up, that's reinforced. The idea that you're not a human, you're nothing but a prison number. Mm. That dehumanization, the random strip searches and the stripping of your dignity and, you know, starvation, solitary confinement and abuses that take place there. It just goes in a complete opposite direction of a system that says it wants to correct behavior. You know, I'm a firm believer that you get out of people what you put into them. And if you pour negativity into them, you can't help but, you know, realize that that's what's going to come out. And in prisons that I've been in, that was the dominant energy.
Studies show that putting a human being into solitary confinement very quickly can lead to mental illness, to a mental breakdown. You spent a lot of time in solitary confinement. What was it, seven and a half years?
Yes, I spent a total of about 7.5 years, and at one point, 4.5 years of that was straight.
Yeah.
And you
how
know,
do you survive that, Shaka? How did you deal with it?
I was blessed and fortunate to be literate, and I read a book called Cages of Steel a couple of years before that long stretch. And in the book, there's I think he's a psychiatrist or a psychologist who explains the mental breakdown that would occur as a person that's subjected to long-term solitary confinement. And he outlined about 30 or 40 different things that the person would begin to exhibit before they mentally just broke beyond repair.
Yeah.
And so having that information, I was able to identify it in the men who were around me. And it made me, it helped me to be able to identify those feelings whenever they emerged within myself. And so what I did is I read whenever I felt myself feeling emotionally or mentally vulnerable. You know, I would just pick up a book by Nelson Mandela or Malcolm X or somebody who had survived some things and overcame obstacles. And that was enough to just get me through. And then after that, I began to write in my own journal. And it was through that process of getting to know myself that I was able to, you know, recognize my own human strength and, you know, meditation and prayer. Those things were all integral parts of me surviving that experience.
Yeah. And a lot of what you share in this book is that, as you just said, it being literary, reading literature, writing, that those were what helped you survive, as well as letters. There's a couple of letters specifically that were also turning points for you. One was from Nancy, the godmother of the man that unfortunately was killed, and the other one from your son. Tell us about those letters.
Well, the letter I received from Nancy, I probably had about 5 or 6 years in, and she wrote me this letter, and I didn't know who Nancy was until I got the letter, and I began to read the letter, and she was explaining the devastation I had caused her family by tragically taking their loved one's life, and that was like one of the most emotionally jarring experiences of my life. Because for the first time, I was able to put a human face to what had occurred that night. And, you know, I realized that I had taken someone's husband, their father, their son, their beloved friend. And I didn't know how to process that. I wasn't emotionally mature enough at the time to fully process what that, you know, experience would mean for me until years later as I began to evolve and, you know, changed the course of my life. And then the second letter I received was from my son, which was my oldest son. I now have a toddler now, but my oldest son, and he explained to me that his mother had told him why I was in prison. And he explained what he felt as a young man growing up without a father and knowing that his father was in prison. And that was just devastating to hear. You know, given the relationship I have with my own father and knowing how I look up to him and knowing that my son was going to grow up looking at me as a monster. And I knew right then that I had to do everything in my power to really turn my life around.
So family connection is how important to somebody who's incarcerated?
I think family and friend connection is the most important because it's really the only thing that offers the glimmer of hope that's needed for, you know, a man or a woman to actually navigate themselves their way through those experiences. It's really sad that, you know, when I was in prison that, you know, I watched a lot of people abandon their loved ones, you know, and it's a hard thing to do. And sometimes it's out of shame. Sometimes it's out of fear of not knowing what to say. But I always encourage people that if you have a loved one, a friend, a family member, the smallest thing as a card or just a letter saying, you know, you made, you know, a poor decision that, you know, landed you in prison, but I'm here. I'm not going to give up on you. I'm not going to judge you.
Yeah.
For the rest of your life or hold you hostage to that moment. And I'm going to be here to support you and help you do whatever is necessary to turn your life around. Like, that means everything. And I try to, you know, as I do this work, I really try to encourage people to volunteer in their local jails and prisons, because ultimately these men and women are returning to our communities, and we have a choice what kind of men and women we want to return. And if we allow them to just be solely subjected to what's happening inside the prison and not have that human touch, not have human empathy and compassion, you know, we can't expect for them to come out here and adjust to society. It's just not realistic.
And yet the system seems to be set up to make those connections to family and friends almost impossible. I was struck as I read your story of how many times you were transferred from one facility to another, and there's no warning given. You can't let your family know. Suddenly you're someplace else, miles and miles away. Why is that, do you think, that really strains those connections?
Yeah, and I mean, it's really sad. Like, I mean, I have been as far as 12 hours away from my family within the same state. And, you know, most of us come from either poor environments or, you know, environments where our family members are just living check to check or just doing enough to get by. And so it's extremely burdensome for families to try to travel that type of distance for really short visits, sometimes non-contact visits. And then the cost of phone calls were extremely high when I was in SAD prison. They're still high by comparison to pay out here. And so that idea that, you know, breaking families down and destroying families as part of the rehabilitative process is really just ridiculous. And, you know, it's the sad thing is that people don't think about the long-term consequences, especially when you're dealing with people who are locked up for a very long time. I remember going years without actually getting a hug or being able to physically touch another human being, you know, and, you know, going years without being able to just hear the voice of my family because I was in solitary. And, you know, there were other times when I didn't even have money to put on my phone where I can contact anybody. And that's a scary place to be in for a family, to not have access to their loved one and know if they're all right. You know, especially for the parents and things like that. So, you know, it's just a really dysfunctional and broken system.
Indeed. And it seems to me that a lot of people out there who, you know, throw out phrases like tough on crime, lock them up and throw away the key, often forget that it's not just the inmate, but it's the family of the inmate that's suffering too. You may be leaving behind a single parent. You may be leaving behind, correct me if I'm wrong, is it 200,000 children in Michigan alone with at least one incarcerated parent? Does that sound right?
I mean, I would probably assume so. I mean, you know, our system here, at one point, there were over 50,000 men and women incarcerated in Michigan alone. I'm not sure what the numbers are today, but I mean, if you think about it,
yeah,
most families have 2 to 3 children. So there's thousands of children who have been impacted by incarceration over the last 4 or 5 decades.
Right.
And those boys that are left, you know, when a parent is absent is something that's really hard to supplement. And, you know, we just haven't done a good job of ensuring that families maintain connections and bonds. And I mean, you know, if you're a parent, you'll try to figure out a way to parent from inside. But it's nothing like being there and being able to touch your loved one and hug your child and console them. And even that, like, you know, when I would have visits, there were times that my son needed to be consoled and I couldn't be the one to console him, you know, because of prison rules. And I'm like, you know, how do you expect for parents to create that bond or maintain bonds when they can't do what instinctively comes to us as parents?
Today, a lot of what you're doing is working for criminal justice reform. And I saw something online about your involvement with hashtag Cut50. Talk to us about what you're trying to do in terms of reform. What kind of reform is needed?
So with Cut50, hashtag Cut50 is an organization that was co-founded by a brilliant woman named Jessica Jackson, who was a former, she's a lawyer. She worked a lot on death row, and Van Jones, who you may know from CNN. And so basically what we're doing is we're working on multiple campaigns to really turn around the prison system. You know, the idea of being tough on the crime has proven not to work. You know, we have a 70% recidivism rate nationally, which is basically a nice way of saying we have a 70% failure rate.
Right.
No other business could run with a 70% failure rate. And so we're working on Clemency Project, which is, you know, helping men and women who were impacted by you know, the drugs sent the scene to return to their family and community. President Barack Obama has been really progressive in working to commute those sentences. I think just yesterday he commuted like 58 sentences, if I'm not mistaken. We're doing a thing called the Year of Empathy, where we're really helping to support those clemency efforts. And we're also working on what's called Beyond Prison, which is really putting a human face to mass incarceration by highlighting the stories of those men and women who have been inside, who have come home and returned as assets instead of liabilities, but also highlighting the impact that incarceration has had on their family. And so it's some of the work that I'm extremely proud of and really excited about.
I'm not sure if you would have seen this, Shaka, but a few weeks back, right around the time that I was reading your book, I caught a 60 Minutes episode on prisons in Germany and how different they are from what we're doing in this country. And their recidivism rate was extremely low. Their whole idea was to treat these people with some dignity and give them some respect. They were able to wear their own clothes. They were able to actually leave the prison at times and spend time with family. They had their own keys to their own cells. They were able to set those cells up almost like a little dorm room. And all of that, you would think, are we spoiling these people or are we punishing them? But their whole idea was exactly what you're saying. We're sending these people back out into society. And it was working.
I was actually there.
Were you?
Yeah, so I was part of that team. And it was mind-blowing to go over there. We were over there for 6 days. Mm-hmm. We visited about six or seven prisons. During the course of that week. So that was, you know, put together. I was invited by the Vera Institute as part of my work with Cut 50. And it was just mind-blowing to see the dramatic difference between what they do in Germany and what we do over here. And, I mean, when you think about it, Germany has a very tough, I'm trying to think of the right word, but, you know, when you think of Germany, you don't always think of, you know, human compassion and empathy. You know, you kind of think about what happened during the World War, and so when I got over there, I was, you know, I was pleasantly surprised to see how progressive they were. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of my time there talking to the men who were incarcerated. You know, I mean, it's okay to talk to administrators, but having been formerly incarcerated, I know that you get the truth from those who are actually serving the time. And what I recognized relatively quickly is that, for one, they don't call them inmates, at least not while I was there. Mm-hmm. They pretty much identify and recognize that these are members of society who may have made a poor decision at one point in their lives, but they still were part of that community. And that's how they treated them. And, you know, the interaction between the officers and the men inside was very human and what you would expect from somebody who's talking to a neighbor, speak. And so the model works, you know, and it proves his work. But the difference, I will say, between Germany and America is that we have such deep racial antagonisms that it's hard to make that connection because, for one, we're just not honest about race relations and we're not honest about the racial implications of the prison system when you have the majority of the men and women inside are, you know, African-American. And the majority of the politicians who are making the decisions are not. So, you know, we don't have that same kindred connection that, you know, Germany has when you're one German looking at you're a white German looking at another white German and making a decision about that his life where you can identify with him because y'all look alike and y'all come from the same culture. Whereas in America, our racial dynamics are very, very different. And, you know, and that's played out, you know, when you think about the war on drugs and the disparity between sentencing laws with, you know, the ratio being 500 to 1 for crack cocaine compared to powder. And, you know, and I think those numbers have been reduced now, but they're still significantly high in terms of the ratio. So, you know, that's one of the stark differences there. And the other thing was that they don't use solitary confinement to break people's souls the way that we do here in this country. And when I explained to the warden there that I had served, you know, how much time I served in solitary she began to visibly weep. Mm. Said, we would never do that to one of our citizens. And that moment for me made me look at my own experience very different.
Yeah.
You know, and it was one of the first times that I ever was able to really look at my experience from a very compassionate perspective. Because here it is, the warden of a prison in Germany was saying that that was cruel to the degree that they would never do it to one of their citizens.
So is that one of the first things that in an ideal world that you would change in our prison system, abolish solitary confinement? Or is there a purpose to it ever?
I would definitely abolish the usage of long-term solitary confinement. When I mean long-term, anything beyond a day or a few hours, to me, is designed to hurt as opposed to heal. And so the only role I can see, you know, for it is if it's just a temporary moment to calm a situation down or something like that. Outside of that, I just don't see no use for it. And then the reality is the majority of men and women who are in solitary suffer from mental illness. At least that was my experience when I was in solitary. It's like the majority of my neighbors, surrounding neighbors, were on some type of psychotropic drug and had very clearly defined mental illnesses and manifested in some ways that were very traumatic for me and others who were around in that environment.
And what are your thoughts on, you mentioned the war on drugs. There is another movement underway now to change our approach to that, to see drug addiction as a mental illness, as a disease, to be treated in a medical facility rather than throwing people into jail. And that's assuming that you're not selling to others or that there's not some criminal activity involved. What are your thoughts on drug offenders?
A lot of times the supplier and the user are the same person. You know, some people sell to feed their own habits. Mm. And addiction, you know, is rooted in, and you know, definitely should be treated as a mental health issue as opposed to a criminal issue. And, you know, I think the legalization of certain drugs, I think that makes a lot of sense when you consider the fact that you can freely go buy tobacco and alcohol. And it's proven that, you know, nothing bad is going to happen as a result of legalizing, for example, marijuana. You know, Colorado has done a great job of proving that. And so I just think that, you know, the idea that you punish people and send them to prison for a very, very long time based on, you know, drug possession or drug use or drug selling, I just think is ridiculous.
Your basic sense of human nature and those that crossed your path during your years of incarceration, can anyone change? Is there hope for all?
I believe that humans, by definition, are capable of and worthy of redemption. And they're truly redeemable. We're truly redeemable.
Yeah.
You know, what I experienced in prison through, you know, being kind of like the guy that everybody came to with their problems and talked to about life, what I discovered is that most of us came from backgrounds of extreme hurt in our childhood, in our most of our developmental years. We were all subjected to things that really changed our outlooks on lives, on our lives. And so when the awareness is there that this is what happened to cause me to be the person that I am or contributed to that, you know, that's fixable, you know. And I've watched men turn their lives around. I mean, my mentors, you know, and I have some great mentors. I have some great mentors out here in society now. But the best mentors I've ever had are serving life sentences, and some of them are probably going to die in prison.
Yeah.
You know, actually, most of them are going to die in prison. Sometimes it's hard for me to say that, but it's the truth nonetheless. And these are men who raised me. These are men who gave me books and challenged my thinking and, you know, pushed me to be my best self. And, you know, now these are men who are extremely proud of the fact that I'm, you know, a New York Times bestselling author and I'm doing amazing work nationally and internationally. And if they're redeemable, I believe anybody's redeemable because they redeem me.
Yeah. So what can we do, the average person out there? What do you suggest that we do if we want to see this system change?
I think the average person has to get a comprehensive understanding of what the system is. Shockingly, not a few months ago, President Barack Obama entered the prison as the first sitting president to enter a prison.
Yeah.
And I mean, when you think about that, you know, even President Clinton, who passed the 1994 crime bill, which caused this prison explosion, had never stepped foot inside a prison. I think that was a courageous step because it allowed him to come in close proximity to the problem. And once you're in close proximity to it, then you can fix it. And that, and as you know, again, it's one of the reasons I wrote the book. And you know, as you can attest, it brings you as close to the prison experience as possible without you having to be incarcerated. And so I encourage men and women to go inside, volunteer. Prisons are always looking for people to come run different type of groups, your local county jails, like really get an insider's look into what your tax dollars are paying for. You know, as adults who you know, maybe invested in, you know, stocks and bonds or 401ks or and all these other different things we invest in, most people who invest at least take a look into what they're investing in to figure out, okay, is this a wise investment or not? And sadly, not many of us who are deeply invested in the prison system due to our tax dollars being allocated in a manner that outpaces us, our investments in universities, we're completely blind to what is happening with our dollars that we've invested in. So I just want people to figure out how to take the veil off of this system, and hopefully righting my wrongs can be a contributing part of that. But even outside of that, just going inside prisons can make a world of difference.
And you're going to be here in Kalamazoo on May 27 at Book Bug. What can the audience expect to hear?
Well, yeah, on May 27th, I'll be at the Book Bug in Kalamazoo, and they can expect for me to read some from the book, answer some, you know, do a Q&A, you know, talk a little bit about the system, about what's next, and just look forward to having a really good human time, and I hope they bring a bunch of hugs out. I like hugs, so...
There you go. We can all use more hugs.
Definitely.
Well, thank you, Shaka. This has been fascinating to talk with you, and a fascinating book. Any other books in the works?
I'm thinking about the follow-up to Righting My Wrongs. I'm also a fiction writer. I have several fiction books out, but I'm looking forward to the next book. I'm just not sure what that next book will be.
I hope it will be something about what we've talked about, how criminal justice reform looks and what we can do about it. But the first book is definitely a necessary one, and I hope the readership continues to grow.
Well, thank you for having me.